Coming up on the show today, the United States is feeling pressure from its Arab allies.
The Arab leaders insisted on an urgent ceasefire to bring in badly needed medical and humanitarian aid for Gaza's civilians, who are facing death and destruction from Israeli bombardment of Hamas militants.
Plus, we visit the West Bank as security tightens amidst a growing conflict.
For those just driving by, Hawara seems like a ghost town. On its main street, there are no people. All shops are closed. Garbage piles up. Only Israeli soldiers walk around.
And coming up later in the show, we'll hear from a former Israeli prime minister. Today is Thursday, November 9th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. On Thursday, some 80 countries and international organizations met in Paris to coordinate aid and assess how to help the wounded in the Palestinian enclave of Gaza, although expectations for concrete results are low without some pause in the fighting. Here's French President Emmanuel Macron.
Today, the situation is grave and is getting worse each day. In the short term, we should work on protecting civilians. And to do this, we need a humanitarian pause very quickly. We have to work towards a ceasefire. It must be made possible.
And in a late-breaking development on Thursday, National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby said that there would be two humanitarian corridors allowing people to evacuate northern Gaza. In addition to the need for humanitarian aid, the fear that the conflict could widen to the West Bank and beyond is on the mind of diplomats Thursday. Philippe Lazzarini is commissioner of the UN Relief and Works Agency, or UNRWA.
I'm deeply concerned about the potential spillover of the conflict beyond the Gaza. In the West Bank, military incursion by the Israeli forces and settler violence have caused record high death toll among Palestinians. The West Bank is boiling, and if we wouldn't have Gaza today, all our attention would be on the West Bank.
All this as Brazilian security services, together with Israeli and international security and enforcement agencies, say they have foiled a terrorist attack in Brazil, which had been planned by the Hezbollah terrorist organization and financed by the Iranian regime. The targets of the alleged attack were Brazilian Jews and synagogues. In Israel, Shin Bet, the Israeli security agency, released excerpts of interrogations of captured Hamas fighters in which the fighters said that Hamas uses ambulances to transport terrorists and weapons to avoid suspicions, and that Hamas leadership uses schools, mosques, and hospitals for refuge and to launch attacks from. Also on Thursday, the Israeli Defense Forces, or IDF, released video footage of IDF soldiers as they uncovered a weapons production and storage facility in a residential building adjacent to a child's bedroom. On the diplomatic front, Arab allies of the United States continue to press for a ceasefire as Palestinian civilian deaths mount at an alarming rate in Gaza. Analysts say that as anger grows on the Arab streets over civilian casualties and enormous destruction, Arab leaders worry that the security of their own countries and potentially the entire region is increasingly at risk. Dale Gavlak has that story.
Mideast analyst Nicholas Harris of the Washington-based New Lines Institute for Strategy and Policy points to U.S. allies Egypt and Jordan as Arab states that are playing a particularly pivotal role in Israel's conflict with Hamas. The two countries have the region's longest-lasting peace treaties with Israel and have had close intelligence and security cooperation with the Jewish state. Jordan's King Abdullah hosted a meeting last week between U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and the heads of several Arab countries. The Arab leaders insisted on an urgent ceasefire to bring in badly needed medical and humanitarian aid for Gaza's civilians, who are facing death and destruction from Israeli bombardment of Hamas militants. The U.S. and other G7 countries have pressed Israel to allow humanitarian pauses and corridors to allow for the delivery of aid and the release of hostages. Harris told VOA that Egypt and Jordan are vigorously working for a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and would reject any Israeli moves to forcibly displace Palestinians into their countries. He said that concern is particularly acute for Jordan.
Both those countries have potential to have very restive and angry populations turning on their governments. Jordan has dealt pragmatically with Israel, but it is also exposed in a lot of ways because the majority of the population of Jordan happens to be Palestinian by descent. Jordan has responsibility for the Islamic holy sites in Jerusalem. Jordan is a country that even before this conflict erupted was under severe economic pressure that has led to an increase in socio-political activism.
The whole region is sinking into a sea of hatred that will define generations to come, Jordanian Foreign Minister Ayman Safadi warned. He said that any day after scenario for Gaza is not going to be discussed except after the war and the killing are stopped. Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have condemned Israel's conduct in the war. Bahrain has cut business ties with Israel, while Jordan and Turkey have withdrawn their ambassadors. The Organization for the Islamic Conference will host a summit on Gaza in Saudi Arabia on Saturday. Long-term resentment among the Arab public is fuel for extremist groups. Elham Fakhro, an associate fellow at Chatham House's Middle East program in London, told the New York Times, adding, "The region is already walking a delicate balance." The conflict has already spread from Gaza to the West Bank. Bruce Riddell, Emeritus Senior Fellow at Washington's Brookings Institution, told VOA.
What began as a war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza has now spread to a war between Israel and the Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. Much of it caused by settler violence. American allies like King Abdullah, the Bahrainis, are feeling very threatened. They're pleading with the Americans to get the Israelis to stop the bombardment of Gaza.
I will say very candidly, this conflict has roiled up a huge amount of public anger towards Israel, towards us. Barbara Leaf, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, told the U.S. House Foreign Affairs Committee this week, "This is something we're going to have to work through." Meanwhile, the Jordanian Air Force on Sunday airdropped tons of urgent medical supplies to its field hospital operating in Gaza under difficult conditions. The action was taken in coordination with Israel. Israel's blockade and siege of Gaza have put some hospitals out of service. Humanitarian agencies report that aid deliveries through the Rafah border crossing with Egypt have so far been inadequate as essential services in Gaza deteriorate. Dale Gavlak, VOA News, Amman, Jordan.
We heard earlier about the fear of violence spreading to the West Bank. Surrounded by Jewish settlements, the West Bank town of Hawara has been a focus of violence since the beginning of the year, with both Palestinians and Israeli settlers being killed. Now, with violence escalating, Israeli forces decided to shut down the entire central area of the town, not allowing Palestinians to work, drive, or walk on its main street. VOA's Jan Boyshat has the story.
For those just driving by, Hawara seems like a ghost town. On its main street, there are no people. All shops are closed. Garbage piles up. Only Israeli soldiers walk around. Since the beginning of the war, Palestinians have been forbidden to work, walk, or drive on the main street of this Arab town in the West Bank. Moin Demeidi, the mayor of Hawara, says Palestinians cannot even reach a medical center. He says, "We do not have access to any shops, hospitals, or ambulances." He says, "They are completely shut down of any livelihood on this road." Hawara has been a focus of violence in the West Bank. The town is cut off by the main road that crosses the West Bank from north to south, linking important cities like Ramallah and Nablus. It is also surrounded by many Jewish settlements. Before the war between Israel and Hamas broke out, confrontations between settlers and Palestinians were common here, with deaths on both sides. Sami Souza owns a business in Hawara.
The soldiers and the settlers, they come to the street in Hawara and start throwing rock, start throwing bombs to us, and they make us close. We cannot open. We cannot have our business. We cannot open it.
With the escalation of violence, Israeli forces now are preventing Palestinians from crossing from one side of Hawara to the other by car. Almost all the streets that link to the inner parts of town have been blocked off. There is only one point in the central part of the town where residents can cross on foot. Hawara resident Shireen Odeh says the town is now divided into sections. The upper part has some capabilities, some supermarkets. The municipality is on one side, so people are able to survive. But the side she lives on is suffering, she says. We don't have shops or clinics. The Israeli government built a new road to bypass the main street of Hawara. But so far, the Israeli cars keep flowing through the middle of the town. Yambwe Shah, VOA News, Hawara, West Bank.
You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert coming up shortly. Now, it's been 10 years since Ukraine's Revolution of Dignity, an all-Ukraine protest at Kyiv Central Square, as a result of the refusal by then-President Viktor Yanukovych to sign an EU association agreement. Well, things are decidedly different in Ukraine now, and the European Commission has recommended starting membership negotiations with Kyiv. It's another important step to get closer to EU membership. Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
November 8, 2023 became historic for Ukraine in its European integration journey. The European Commission made a recommendation to start the accession negotiations. A decision that millions of Ukrainians have been waiting for years. Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, stated that Ukraine has fulfilled 90% of the recommendations provided by the EU at this stage. In his address to the nation, President Zelensky said that this was the decision Ukraine expected and that there is no alternative to Ukraine's future. He believes that the Ukrainian nation has proved its European affiliation on the battlefield fighting for European values.
Ukrainians have always been and remain part of our common European family. Our country must be in the European Union. Ukrainians deserve it both for the defense of European values and for the fact that even in times of full-scale war, we keep our word and develop state institutions. All the necessary decisions are being adopted.
Now Ukraine is waiting for the European Council's decision in December, and President Zelensky has already instructed the government to ensure the implementation of the state's strategic course towards full membership in the European Union. This includes the completion of the implementation of the European Commission's recommendations mentioned in the enlargement report. Also, the Cabinet of Ministers should initiate consultations with the European Commission regarding organizational aspects of the accession negotiation process, and based on their results and after approval of the decision by the EU summit, make proposals regarding the composition of the negotiating delegation. The government should also improve the coordination of authorities in European integration issues and the practice of developing European integration laws, as well as prepare a draft law on the approval of the new national program for the adaptation of Ukrainian legislation to EU law. Most Ukrainians perceive this long-awaited decision by the European Commission as extremely positive, because for many Ukrainians, among the results of Russia's full-scale invasion, is a desire to become a part of the European family and pull away from Russian influence. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And finally today, Arash Sigarchi is managing editor of VOA's Persian service. He spoke with former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. It's a wide-ranging interview of someone with a unique perspective. as a citizen of Israel and as someone who intimately knows the ins and outs of Israel's military apparatus and diplomatic missions, someone who has himself been wounded in combat and who negotiated with Palestinians. The interview begins with the question of Olmert's first reaction when he became aware of the Hamas attacks on October 7th.
I and my family were in Sicily, outside of Israel, at the end of a week-long vacation for the entire family. I woke up at 6:30 in the morning, which was 7:30 Israeli time, and I saw that I have about 150 messages in my WhatsApp. So I started to roll, and I immediately got a message that something terrible is going on. And the worst part of it was that I have a friend of mine who was my classmate since I was in the kindergarten over 70 years ago. And I got a message, I'm in the safe room, please save me, call the army, call the police, we are attacked by terrorists. So this was the immediate devastating impact of this event. Fortunately enough for us, our flight back to Israel at that day still took off in time, and so in the afternoon I was already in Israel, and I started to go through the same pains and surprises and devastation which I think characterized the entire country.
What do you think about the day? Is that Israel underestimate Hamas?
First of all, I have to say, just to make sure that no one is mistaken, there is nothing in the technological system, the security system, the intelligence system of Israel, which failed or didn't operate. We still have the best systems in the world, but in order to have the best system work, you have to have an alertness of your mind. And what characterized the Israeli attitude is, first of all, arrogance. And we underestimated the Arabs. The common reaction of Israeli until then was, what the hell do they know? We know so much better, we are so smarter, we are so sophisticated, we are so more technological than they are. So it's true, we are. Definitely we are. But they have shown determination and they have fooled us because we were arrogant. And this is a lesson which has to be learned. More modesty will never be damaging.
I want to turn the discussion to Iran. What do you see the role of Islamic Republic of Iran in this attack and after?
Look, there is no question about the dominant role of Iran in establishing a network of terrorist organizations, radical, religious, fundamentalist, atrocious, murderous organizations over the entire Middle East. It's not just the Hamas. Hamas is completely financed and supported and equipped with weapons by Iran. The same is Hezbollah. The same is the Islamic Jihad. So all of these organizations that are trying to upset the balance in the Middle East are financed, organized, supported, inspired by Iran, by the National Republic of Iran and the Ayatollahs. And they're going to pay. Iran is going to pay. Iran is already paying up until now. I wish I could share with you and the viewers of how many things that we were responsible for, which were accomplished in Iran over the few years, at least at the time that I was prime minister. But Iran will pay dearly for trying to create chaos that will upset the lives, that will shatter and shake the foundations of the existence of so many millions of people, not just in Israel, everywhere around Israel. Because they are not after us only, they are after every person who is moderate, who is not extreme, who is not fundamentalist, who is not religious, everything, everyone that is not part of this chaotic state of mind, with this barbaric, intolerant attitude towards the basic values of the Western civilization, they are their enemies. And we will respond at a time, at a place, and at the right way. And believe me, it will be very painful, and it may prove to be very bloody.
Several days after the attack, Iran Khamenei, Ayatollah, tried to put the distance between himself and Hamas and said that was the action of 100% of the action by Palestinians. Do you believe it, and why?
I don't know, of course, all the details, even if I knew what our intelligence knows, I don't think that we should share it on television. I can say to you only this. Iran is an essential part of everything that happened. They are responsible. They take a very central role in triggering it, in inspiring it, in financing it, in coordinating it. Even if there were not Iranians in the on ground with the terrorists, but without Iran, it could never be accomplished.
What about U.S. side? U.S. agree Iran wasn't behind that specific attack?
Well, I think that the statement of America is completely understandable. America wants to signal to Iran that it should not further and expand the military front beyond the immediate confrontation between Israel and Hamas. And therefore, they say that Iran was not involved, and therefore Iran shouldn't now become involved in the military confrontation. And however, in the event that Iran may not completely understand the signal of America, they brought to the region two carriers, the most modern carriers of America, with ballistic missiles and also an atomic submarine. So in the event that Iran may not understand the signals, there is an enormous American power to remind them if it will come to it.
Let me turn to north of Israel and attacks by Hezbollah. You were in the office as a prime minister when Lebanon's second war happened. What's the difference between this war and the previous one you were in charge?
First of all, the war that I was in charge of in 2006 was directly between Israel and Hezbollah. And I think that the outcome of that war was devastating to Hezbollah. Number one, the entire section of Beirut, the Dahya, which was completely controlled by Hezbollah, and it had tens of huge towers of 30 floors and more, was all flattened. Everything that Hezbollah was in charge of was destroyed. And the chief of Hezbollah, Sheikh Nasrallah, said immediately after the operation, had I known, had he known, 1% of what the reaction of Mr. Olmert will be, he would have never started. So at that time, it was a direct confrontation, full-fledged, across the board, from east to west. And the outcome kept Hezbollah for 17 years in the bunkers. To this day, Nasrallah still lives in a bunker, and he knows why. So now, I think, for the time being, Nasrallah seems not to want to expand this confrontation beyond a minimal degree necessary in order to show his empathy for the Hamas, but without risking a full confrontation with Israel, which may result in a similar outcome for Hezbollah, and perhaps worse. So I think this is quite obvious for the time being, but knowing the temper of Nasrallah, and also one has to always remember that when you start these skirmishes, which expand to shooting rockets to the nearby area, it can go out of control and develop into something which was not even was designated in advance. Therefore, I would be careful. I wouldn't say that it can't expand into a full confrontation between Israel and Hezbollah. Presently, I see an attempt to control it to the minimum that they think is of some significance, but not beyond it.
Ehud Olmert was Prime Minister of Israel from 2006 to 2009. He was speaking with the managing editor of VOA's Persian service, Arash Sigarchi. And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA Podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.